The Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It is Wednesday the 15th. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you. So we're going to have a couple of members coming in and out. I know that Senator Dembrough is on the way. So there's two of us, which means we can't do any work sessions.
We can do an informational on 51.
That's going to take a long time. So what we're going to do is stand at ease for 5 minutes until we get another. Oh, we're not standing at ease.
Okay.
Excellent. All right. Thank you. And Denver's on his way. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 239.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 239 establishes a process to determine consent of residents in a residential care facility or adult foster home to individually based limitations of certain rights upon a finding that the resident is incapable of providing or withholding consent. It also defines terms. There was a public hearing on this bill on February 8th. There's a sub-referral to Judiciary and to Ways and Means. And there's also a -1 amendment. And -1 clarifies provisions, modifies membership of consent determining committees for the residential care facilities and adult foster homes. It permits residents to contest the incapacity determination in a contested case hearing. It clarifies that the incapacity determinations cannot be used to cause substantial or irreversible physical impairments. It adds the freedom from restraint to enumerated rights subject to limitation procedures, and it changes or and it adds an effective date of the 91st day after signee die. There is a minimal fiscal impact on the -1 amendment and no revenue impact on the -1.
And I'd like to invite up Calm and Bob Jundiff, who have been, and Karen, do you want to come up too, Minnis? You're good? Okay. So you'll recall when we heard this bill before, we had some questions, and these gentlemen have spent a lot of time together. And they're here to update us on their very close friendship.
Chair Gelsen, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I have been working on behalf of a work group on Senate Bill 239, which is really designed to conform Oregon law with federal regulations governing home community-based services standards and how they're applied in communities. And so, very quickly, this just has to do with circumstances in which there needs to be a limitation placed on a person who's living in a APD-licensed residential facility. And when that person is unable to give consent because they are incapacitated, the question is how that consent could be provided by someone who's acting on their behalf. And that's what the bill is about. It's very narrowly drawn just to those very limited circumstances. And there have been some concerns raised, technical concerns and other concerns, that the bill might be interpreted more broadly, which was not our intent. And so among a number of people that we've worked with, we have worked with Calm and his colleagues in order to make sure that there are no unintended consequences of this bill.
Thank you. Calm?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Cullum Willis, and I'm here at the request of Oregon Rights Life, and I just want to say thank you for hearing our concerns and for addressing them. We believe that the -1 amendment to this bill does address our concerns, and as long as it doesn't change, we won't be opposing the bill.
Thank you. So these folks have worked really hard on the amendments. Are there questions for them while they're here?
Yeah, I am glad. I had concerns at the beginning, but now that I think I understand the amendment where you have a long-term care ombudsman as a part of the group that would make any decisions, isn't that correct?
Chair Gelser, Senator Monsander said, yes, indeed.
Yes. And as long as they're an advocate, not necessarily from the facility, but for the patient, that was my biggest concern. Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions for these folks? Seeing none, are people comfortable making a motion and moving this on down to judiciary today? Is that okay with everyone? All right. Senator Monda Sanderson, would you?
Okay. Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 239.
Senator Monda Sanderson moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 239. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it would just be my hope that since the people have worked so hard in this particular policy committee to, I think, create a delicate balance that everybody agrees to, that the Judiciary Committee will see that and hopefully kind of honor that. Because I think if any of this gets undone, it becomes a lot more complicated and likely creates a lot of no votes.
And Senator Knope, I would agree with that assessment. It would be my intent to oppose any further changes to the bill that were substantive. I think the Judiciary Committee wants to make sure we have the legal pieces the right way. But in terms of what's been negotiated and what it is, we're sending Senator Dimbrough to the committee, and I will go visit the committee. And my commitment is to continue supporting this bill as long as it stays intact with the negotiation that was there. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Monda Sanderson.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 239 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and then the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Monda Sanderson moves that. Thank you. That's very helpful. Move Senate Bill 239 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and then the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? No, I would just like to thank Bob and Colm for really sticking it out and working hard, and all the partners that worked with you for being willing to listen to each other and work through some challenges and trust each other. It's the way that this is supposed to work. So thank you both very, very much. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And Senate Bill 239 moves on from our committee.
And no being. Alan being excused.
And Alan, this guy, Senator Olson, is excused from that. And then the other work session's really fast. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 239, open the work session on Senate Bill 830.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 830 modifies the definition of a foster parent who is a current caretaker of a ward to include those currently caring for the ward and who has cared for the ward or ward sibling for 12 cumulative months or cumulatively one half of the ward or sibling's life when the ward is or sibling is under the age of two.
Thank you. So we heard this bill the other week. DHS got back to us, said they had no requested changes. And Senator Monda Sanderson, would you be willing to make the motion?
Senator Gelser, I move a Senate Bill 830 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And does it have
further.
Okay, with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monda Sanderson moves Senate Bill 830 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and I'm happy to carry that one. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 830 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 833.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 833 requires law enforcement agencies to adopt procedures for referring a person who attempted suicide or family member of a person who commits suicide to a peer support program. It requires the hospital that discharges a patient following an attempted suicide to facilitate the referral of the patient to a peer support program.
Okay, thank you very much, Matt. Whichever legislator would like to lead off.
Sure. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8. It's always nice to be in this committee. And especially with my counterpart from the other side, Representative Kenny Geyer, and Representative Bueller is our other co-sponsor on the bill. This really is very simple. It just says that when you go to the hospital and it could be you have attempted suicide or your child has attempted suicide or unfortunately your child or loved one has completed a suicide, that as part of that discharge, as part of leaving, and the same is true when law enforcement encounters you, that they provide you with a release of information that would allow them to give your name and telephone number to a peer support organization that can reach out and contact you. As I've talked with families that have survived, either have lost loved ones due to suicide, or families that are struggling surviving a suicide attempt, it's often very difficult to pick up the phone and call that organization, and there's a lot that's very overwhelming. And to be able to have other survivors in these peer support organizations be able to proactively reach out is something that many survivors have said would be very helpful to them. So that's really all it does. It says you'll get a release, you'll sign the release, and then somebody can call you. Not mandatory to sign the release.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Representative, what a pleasure.
Nice to be here in front of my own senator and for the rest of the committee as well. I am State Representative Alyssa Kinnegeyer, House District 46, southern half of Senator Dembrough's district, southeast, northeast Portland. And I'm really delighted to co-chief sponsor this. I'm sorry that Representative Bueller could not be here because we've worked a lot, particularly on the hospital discharge side. I have not done as much on the law enforcement side, but certainly you know from this committee, because you have such a champion here, of how huge a problem suicide is. We have among the highest rates in the country on suicide. And we've also done a good job of developing a peer support infrastructure, and yet we're not connecting those things well enough. And so this is a great attempt to do it. I just want to put it on the hospital discharge side in the context of what we've done over the last couple of years. So I'm not as familiar with the law enforcement side, but in the hospital discharge side, we all had a bill last year that then went to you and passed out of this house, out of the legislature, that was asking hospitals to come up with discharge policies when people present to hospitals in an acute crisis. And this is building on that. So it's going from that statute and putting in a piece. And when they're doing that, when they're doing these discharge policies, part of what they need to do is to encourage people to a release of information so that they can give the information to the peer support. There's no mandate. There's no teeth. There's no getting a hospital in trouble if they don't do it. It's really an encouragement here to do that. And we do have another bill that will be coming to you that is expanding on that, not in this particular way, calling out peer support, but what you will be seeing ahead of you is we started with what this refers to is the hospitals that formally admit patients, that actually admit them and have psychiatric beds. We are going to be taking the bill that we did last year and asking hospitals to go through the same kind of discussion they had to come up with discharge plans when they don't have psychiatric beds. So we're going to get out to more of the rural hospitals. We're not asking them to do all the exact same things because we know the capacity may be less, but we want them to go through the same process of coming up with protocol. So these are all attempts to build on the work that we did 2 years ago, and I'm very supportive.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for? Yes, Senator Munson.
Having dealt with youth in particular and suicide, I was just curious. When someone's in the hospital, I don't know enough about how long they hold them, but Usually, when you discharge them, even though there's a release of information, my experience is that they're not going to follow up with someone else. I know hospitals probably can't do this, but it sure would be nice to have a contact in the hospital as soon as someone's in there, because that relationship in the hospital sometimes can, just like the hotline works, when you have someone on the hotline talking to you, that person identifies with your situation and gets you out, you know, may de-escalate the trauma that the person is feeling. So I don't know if you've talked about that or discussed.
Well, we, again, last year, 2 years ago, the effort that we did on discharge policies was really to start the conversation. And the Hospital Association did a fantastic job. They came up, we had kind of broad framework in our bill, and they came up with much more prescriptive guidelines and some really excellent work. And we're eager to hear how that's being implemented. It was, you know, as far as we could get at that point in time, and it had things like when you come in with an acute crisis, mental health crisis, you should have a follow-up appointment within 7 days. And there was a lot of debate about, does that someone in the hospital that does that, who sets up the appointment and then does the follow-up, somebody else? So in addition to expanding our hospital discharge bill this year to rural hospitals that don't admit and don't have psychiatric beds, we have a second bill that is a continuity of care bill that really tries to get at who does that referral and can we make sure that it's reimbursed. So we actually will have two bills coming to you that are trying to get at some of those issues. One of the things that best practice is supposed to be now is if you come in with having an attempted suicide, you really need follow-up care within 48 hours. That's the best, not the 7 days, which is what we expect of CCOs for a mental health crisis. But if it's actually suicide, it's got to be 48 hours. And the statistics show that the highest rate of suicide after an attempt is actually in the next 24 hours. And then after that, the following 24 hours. So, you know, we're still trying to get at it. I think linking people to peer support services is one critical piece. Certainly, there are many pieces.
And Chair Monis Anderson, in terms of this specific bill, I think your point is a very good one, and it may be worth a modest amendment on page 2, and rather than requiring that encouragement to sign that referral happen at discharge, that it we could make that a little looser, that they're in the hospital and they're able to sign that if they're going to be in the hospital for a while and somebody could come. But it does go back to that piece of they're not going to make the phone call themselves. We need to create that pathway through that release so that somebody that can walk that journey with them is able to get to them.
I think that would be a real improvement, actually, to try to get that relationship started while the person is in. And then perhaps the outreach could actually happen before they were released.
And I do want to remind you that where this fits in the current statutes is for people who are actually admitted to hospitals. So when a further bill comes that deals with emergency department discharge, not formally admitted, what we're asking is not that they follow all the exact same protocol that's come out here or that's in the guidelines that have been developed, but that they just visit those issues and come up with their own protocols, because we recognize that there's not as much capacity, but they should still go over the same kinds of things that are in this statute, which is, you know, how might you link to peer services and, you know, how can you do a follow-up visit and how do you make your policies publicly available? So the things that are in that, we're not prescribing what they should be, but we're just saying you need to have the same conversation. So that one will hopefully pass out of our committee and come to yours, but it will not have to follow all the same exact whatever you come up with for this bill.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any further questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have people signed up, Matt? So just bring them all up. Craig Campbell?
And he said he does not need to come. Sorry.
Okay.
Unless you changed your mind. You're welcome to come back. Okay.
And we have Laura Rose Massaris and David Westbrook. So, Craig, why don't you go ahead?
So, protocol. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. There were just a couple of items we wanted to identify. One, suicide issues that come to us in our hospitals are pretty acute. We had 114 different cases in 2015, and it's very critical that as we have this discussion that's in this bill, that we also make sure that that discussion continues in that kind of continuum of care, warm handoff process that working, that you're going to see in, hopefully, in House Bill 3090, and that the protocols that the Oregon Health Authority is working on now are included in that discussion as well. They're doing a really good job of starting to identify what those warm handoffs are and how they should happen. One of our concerns, not with the bill in particular, but more with the availability of peer support, is we only have peer support training in about 8 cities in Oregon. And although there is a peer support network, it really needs to be much more robust. So that's something that we're going to continue to have a need for discussing to make sure that when we do provide somebody to leave the hospital dealing with the issues surrounding suicide, whether it was successful or not, that we make sure that that peer support is actually present and capable of taking on that additional burden. And so that's my comments for the moment. So thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you very much. And do we have Laura Rose and David Westbrook, please? Welcome.
Go Chair Gelsler, members of the committee. My name is David Westbrook. I'm the chief operating officer at Lines for Life, where we operate Oregon's only statewide suicide line. We have taken hundreds of thousands of calls from individuals who are contemplating suicide, family members of suicide, and loved ones of suicide over about a decade, a little more than a decade. So we're very familiar with suicide, and we applaud the committee and the sponsors for taking on this issue. We feel that this would be a strong move towards preventing suicide. We also feel that it could be strengthened in some of the ways that have just been identified, and that is primarily through introducing a hotline component to it. So I'd like to tell you briefly about two programs that we're currently doing. One is with Cedar Hills Hospital. These are patients who have been in an inpatient situation, very similar to what this bill is talking about. When they're discharged, our agreement with Cedar Hills is that they will, when appropriate, refer to Lines for Life, and we then make the phone call back to the patient for the same reasons that you identified here, because it's very difficult to get them to take those steps to make them call the call themselves. We then follow up within 24 hours, 10 days, and 30 days with these individuals, and more often if it's an acute situation. So we believe that not only are those follow-up calls appropriate to emergency department discharges, but also in situations like this. Also, as Craig identified, there are a limited number of peer support programs around the state. In fact, there are 24 agencies which are certified to provide peer support training, and all of those agencies are up and down the I-5 corridor, leaving out Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, and the entire coast, meaning that the likelihood of being able to find a peer support person in those areas may be difficult for both law enforcement and the hospitals. Having already had a connection to a helpline in that situation, these individuals are more likely to establish rapport with us, and we're more likely able to reach into all of the corners, every community in the state. That is not to say that that should supplant. It should not supplant the peer support. That ongoing peer support is vital for these individuals. It's simply another component of what we feel is already a strong bill and would make it stronger. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Chair and members of this committee. My name is Laura Rose Maceres, and I live in Kaiser, Oregon. I'm really grateful to be able to be here today. I want to thank everybody so much for the work that brought us to this point today. I'm sharing from personal, family, and community observation and experience. I try to give my volunteer time to advance peer support services in our state with multiple groups and coalitions and committees. I'm privileged to serve on the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council, the Children's System Advisory Council, the Suicide Prevention Alliance, the Youth Suicide Prevention Committee, and recently, there's the development edition of Oregon Peer Delivered Services Coalition, also Oregon Consumer Survivor Coalition, and others. I'm not here as a representative of those because I can't speak for those entire groups, but in my personal involvement, I've been very committed to this cause. We've been communicating to the state from the people in the communities the needs that we still continue to have. So I wear many hats, and I also do some consulting for organization development for organizations that offer peer support. Peer support is a lifeline. As hard as we've been working on advancing clinical practices, I continue to see people and families falling through the cracks, especially our youth and young adults. My daughter experienced horrific PTSD and depression symptoms in her school. When she was coping with issues, said it would take 2 days to get a team person out to even talk to her. 2 days would have been too late. She had to go to the hospital multiple times before they would finally provide treatment. Unfortunately, our first encounter, she was simply told, you shouldn't feel that way, and was given no assessment, no follow-up. I'm really hopeful that it's continued to improve. I know that our doctor has specifically said, you know, there's certain hospitals that are better to go to than others. I know that it's going to be a challenge. I agree that there's some considerations about the accessibility of peer support. The good thing about peer support is that there are so many different varieties that it can be regionally specific. It can address regional issues, whether it's through a hotline, a warm line, whether it's in person, that kind of thing. One of our community members that gave me permission to share pieces of her story, she was in the hospital, I believe, almost 18 times in 18 months. And when she got out, one time she was given an opportunity to start a relationship with a peer support person. It was only two appointments or three, and then it was canceled. Like, this person wasn't going to be available, and they weren't going to provide further peer support for whatever, I think, capacity reason it was. And she ended up right back in the hospital. It's such an important relationship and an attachment, and it can really begin the path of healing. I was so privileged to have family support, peer support of other parents, family members who had walked through the process of having their child receive services with special needs, and that was invaluable. It helped me focus better and make better decisions, I believe, for my daughter. And and now she's back at home, and she's doing really well in the community, and she's back in high school. Anyway, so peer support is just so valuable. One thing I just heard from somebody yesterday that was really inspiring, they said to me that the network for Alcoholics Anonymous that they've been involved with, they said if somebody at the hospital, a doctor, talks to a patient and says, would you like to talk to somebody, that they're able to pick up the phone and they're able to have somebody contact that person within an hour. Wow. I want that for peer support for behavioral health in our state for all Oregonians. I will do whatever I can to make that happen. Thank you so much, and we're happy to do whatever we can to strengthen peer support in our state, and we really appreciate the work of our state. One of the huge pieces that's been so valuable is being able to work on those councils like the OCAC and the CSAC, and working now with the Suicide Prevention Alliance. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both. Yes? Okay. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 833? Seeing none, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 833. We'll work on getting those amendments drafted. And show me that note again at 2:30. Okay. Great. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 51. And this is a placeholder bill, so you don't have to read the whole thing.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 51 establishes a task force on behavioral health.
Great. So we'll invite Lynn Saxton, Royce Bolin, and Ben Miller, please. And we have, for this item, we have until about 2 o'clock, and we've got a handful of people after you guys to talk.
So. Great. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, and with me today on my left, I have Dr. Ben Miller, who's the Director of the Eugene Farley Center at University of Colorado. And Royce Bolin on my right, who is the Behavioral Health Director for the Oregon Health Authority, working in the Health Policy and Analytics Division under the leadership of Director Leslie Clement, who, although not at the table with us today, deserves a remarkable amount of credit for us being able to be here at the table today with the Behavioral Health Collaborative Report. This work began last July, following about 18 months of work by the Oregon Health Authority to begin to aggressively bring behavioral health solutions into the healthcare system in Oregon to produce better results for Oregonians. So I'm going to start off today by just giving you an overview of our current behavioral health system, and I want to say before I do this that this is a reflection of the challenge before us, not the caliber and commitment of the work that is currently underway throughout the substance use disorder community and the behavioral health community. There is a lot of exceptionally good work going on serving people, but the system has some structural deficits and some real results concerns that we have, and we hope to be able to advance improvements in the very near future. I want to particularly call your attention in this honeycomb chart to the fact that currently only 46% of adults received mental health treatment last year that needed that treatment, that 14.6% of teenagers in Oregon experienced a major depressive episode in the last year. We've discussed suicide. It's a critical issue in Oregon. We have the 13th highest suicide rate in the United States today. And also of particular concerns on the far right is that only 46% of results who of adults who receive mental health help feel that it helps them. And then when you look at the statistics for Oregon in terms of alcohol dependence or abuse, opioid abuse, dependency on illicit drugs, the 11% of Oregonians dependent on illicit drugs receiving treatment, and only 45% of youth who had a major depressive episode receiving treatment, you can see the reason why we're concerned and why we have are bringing forward to you today some specific recommendations for producing better results for Oregonians. The prevalence data slide, I think these are really helpful. Part of the thing we talk about a lot in Oregon is the fact that the size of the state makes these challenges solvable. And I think what we're hoping to bring to the behavioral health challenge is both clear problem statements, clear resource analysis, and clear deployment of resource to need in an effective way. But you can see of our population, I'd call your attention to the top, the large blue ball is that 692 adults experience mental illness, and our goal would be to outline in our work plan over the coming biennium concrete gains in serving the entire population of need, both with mental illness and substance use disorders, as well as addressing the children in the system who currently
and
are
you
not.
you do mean 692,000.
Thanks. Sorry. Thank you so much, Senator Moss Anderson. Okay, this next chart shows the Oregonians served by behavioral health programs. It separates out the Medicaid from the non-Medicaid and the Medicaid SUDs. And again, part of what we're trying to do is quantify the challenge so that we can be strategic and effective in addressing the challenge and making Oregon's results in progress measurable on an annual basis to ensure that we get to our goal. The next slide is about our peer support investment in Oregon. This is the financial investment. As you've heard, there is a lot of excellent peer support built around the state, but an insufficient amount to meet the needs. We have had a remarkable increase over the past biennium. We expect to make continuing progress. And I think the critical issue here when we look at these client counts, given the numbers I've just given you, is we're starting this work, but we are a long ways from getting the capacity that we need to meet the needs of the population. We began this work last summer very much aware that in the stand-up of the ACA and in the stand-up of the CCOs and Oregon's results-driven healthcare system, the behavioral health system had not been fully integrated and that we had much work to do to realize the expectations that all of us had for healthcare integration in our state. We have had and do have fragmented financing, fragmented delivery systems, and services that can result in poor health outcomes. We have insufficient access to culturally and linguistically appropriate services, And most importantly, we've lacked a cohesive plan to integrate and treat the whole person. And I would add to that, we've lacked a systems-driven approach to looking at matching investments by the state to results for Oregonians. We've had poor integration between criminal justice systems, human services systems, schools, health. It's just been difficult to get all of those systems working together and then to develop the strategies that we need to promote prevention and early education on wellness. Again, we're consistently focused in our state's healthcare system on getting upstream as much as possible. Everything gets more expensive as time goes on, to say nothing of the human impact as people fail to get access to what they need to be healthy and successful. Our priorities for our behavioral health system is first and foremost one that works for all Oregonians, that improves outcomes for consumers, improves equitable access to effective services in every part of the state. When we began mapping behavioral health services in Oregon 2 years ago, we immediately saw and have since seen reflected the consistent lack of a full array of services throughout the state and tremendous gaps in depending on your age and depending on the issue that you're affected by in the services available to you in your region. We've had a sharp focus on improving efficiency and cost effectiveness in services. We very much believe in a no wrong door approach. I think some of the things we were just talking about with regard to suicide are very much about, again, making sure that people, that it's easy to connect to services, not difficult. We're very focused on mental health and substance use disorder services being seamlessly tied to all aspects of care. I mentioned prevention and health promotion. And finally, system-wide accountability. We should be able to look every year at the investment we've made in behavioral health and substance use disorder services and to determine what those investments produced for the people we are serving. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Miller. I do want to say that we've been working with Dr. Miller since July on the collaborative. He came to us and has brought many resources and tools and perspective from other states on best practice behavioral health systems, and he's been a great partner and also has shown a willingness to show up in Oregon on short notice, which we also appreciate. On rainy days.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Miller. I'm an associate professor of family medicine and the director of the Farley Health Policy Center at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. It's an honor to be here before you and to talk a little bit about something that I'm quite proud of. As Director Saxton alluded to, over the last several months, we've had the opportunity to partner with OHA and members of your community to do something that ultimately could become quite transformative for the state. This is a unique opportunity, and as you can see here on the slide here, most states, when they begin to address issues around mental health and substance use, do so in the context of not having a system to actually modify. Most states don't have a system for anything when it comes to health care. And so what we wanted to do at the initiation of this was to begin to say things like, how do we have consistency in our process? How do we actually create coordination in our care? The words that have been mentioned in this room so far around fragmentation and seamless, how do we avoid fragmentation? How do we integrate? And how do we make this more seamless for the person? That was the goal, and this is the opportunity. Next slide, please. To do this, though, we needed a next-generation system. We needed standards that would allow for consistency. We needed some type of local governance that allowed for the unique needs of each community to take into account how local leadership can adapt and provide some type of oversight and control. We needed transparency. No smoke and mirrors here, no pretending that we're doing something when we're not. This was ultimately about how can we be held accountable for what we're ultimately trying to deliver when it comes to behavioral health. And then most importantly, as Director Saxton alluded to, we needed accountability. Without accountability, a lot of this stuff just becomes really good ideas that show up on paper that don't actually make a difference in people's lives. How do you hold communities and systems accountable for care? Next slide, please.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, as you'll recall, we This work was preceded by the behavioral health town halls, which you participated in, as did Senator Knoop, and Senator Deborah was there, and Senator Montes Anderson. I really appreciate the commitment everyone made to this effort. We had 7 town hall meetings across the state. We had very robust attendance, and we had 2 key themes, which were the systemic challenges consumers faced and also the need for holistic support. 613 people attended, 550 were behavioral health consumers. And I just want to call out that one of the things that we did in order to ensure that we were listening as opposed to telling and talking to is we really asked people to identify what's working for them currently in the system. And I think that was, personally, I feel that was our greatest single takeaway, is to hear from people what is working for them and to understand what they prioritize as what they need to be successful in their communities. And that work then led to the collaborative that we convened.
One of the most effective ways to assess what's working and what's not is to look at data. And one of the products that we created out of the collaborative that I think is actually really impressive, that doesn't look so impressive on a static slide, is a series of web pages that allow you to look at data specific to mental health and substance use in the state, to focus on counties, and to look at things like how can we showcase services that are offered in our state? How can we look at and see who is responsible or who is delivering what service in what part of the state? We on this map that you can see here, this is just a snapshot, and so obviously you can click on all kinds of buttons and zoom in and zoom out. We allowed for people to use this map to look at service location, to look at the prevalence of mental health and substance use in communities, to look at how much state funding went into each county. And so you can actually begin to see across the entire state what's happening where and for whom. The goal here is to be able to identify some of the successes as well as some of the issues that arise. It's really hard to argue with objective data, and when it's put on a map like this, you begin to see a fuller picture of what's happening in the state. And ultimately, what we wanted to do, though, is not just to have a product that was almost an academic exercise. We wanted this to be used by people in the community, where they can go and say, well, what are the services that are offered in my county? Or what's the driving distance between where I live and the next service provider in my part of town? Next slide, please. So as Director Saxon alluded to, we were able to host a series of meetings every other week, starting in July, that consisted of quite a few diverse stakeholders. And you can see examples of the stakeholders on the room. I want to call out a couple of them on the slide, excuse me, call a couple of them out. Obviously, so much of what we wanted to do needed to be driven by the people receiving care. So you had consumer representatives. You had individuals in the room that represented systems. You had representatives in the rooms that understood the payment mechanisms. All of these things really went into ultimately what Royce will talk about in just a second of the recommendations. But this was a very heterogeneous group. Meeting every other week is very time intensive, especially when you are a volunteer group. But yet consistently, we had high turnout. People showed up, they were engaged, they were passionate, they were motivated. And I think that that shows in the final product that you'll see here today. Next slide, please. The values. We like to talk a lot about non-negotiables or principles, but really what this comes down to are what are the values that we're trying to emphasize when we redesign or create a system that's truly accountable for behavioral health. A few of those. Number one, it's got to be about the person. If we forget about the person and the family in the context of community, we've missed the boat. It's got to be, as Director Saxon alluded to, more upstream. We have to shift the mean and be more proactive and practice prevention. We need to be informed around how we're addressing trauma in multiple settings. It needs to be seamless, and we must continually keep an eye on that North Star of how do we integrate services, how do we integrate care. There needs to be alignment between the clinical service delivered and payment. This might ultimately look like how do we ensure that the goals, the outcomes that are necessary to help someone get better can be financially supported. And then most importantly, we've got to measure all of this. It falls flat if we don't hold people accountable based on real data. We have to be able to measure what's working, what's not, and how much. Next slide. Two things to bring to your attention before Royce goes into the recommendations. We thought it was really critical to establish this work in what we think of as a conceptual framework. And forgive me for being a bit academic for just a second. But many times when we start talking about transformation in a state, people immediately go to programs and they say, we want a new program. And that's fine. Programs are great. But it's actually systems level transformation that allows some of those programs to be sustained. It allows those programs to be connected to one another and not fragmented in and of themselves. The person in the family, as I mentioned, was at the center of this. Our collaborative is what we like to think of as that translator level. They were the interface between the community and the systems and policy. They were the people that could speak both languages. Obviously, paying attention to the system and then recognizing the impact the policy has on the system was essential for us. Next slide, please.
And I'm going to have to ask you to...
I'm hurrying.
Sorry.
That's okay. And this is a really pretty slide. Royce, go. This is simply just pointing out that we really wanted to ground behavioral health in a population health approach. I'll turn it over to Royce now.
I do want to just touch on, and you see before you, the tribal process. As we know, the tribes are, the nine federally recognized tribes are sovereign nations. We have a separate consultation process underway to create recommendations specific to behavioral health services. And we do recognize and acknowledge, and part of our momentum in this work is driven by the fact that Oregon's American Indian and Alaska Native populations experience a disproportionate amount of mental health and substance use disorders. We're very committed to reducing those disparities and to work with current funding sources to ensure both that they're not diminished, but also that they are high impact and produce the results the tribes are seeking. So that work is underway. We very much view the tribes as the appropriate provider for services to tribal people, and we'll continue to honor the government-to-government relationship we have with them and report to you on our work.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Royce Bullen. I am the OHA Behavioral Health Director. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I'm going to talk about the recommendations and the product in a very high-level overview. Make sure I'm on the right slide since I'm in charge of both. So when we went through this process, we came up with these four or five or six different areas that we really wanted to highlight. And we've mentioned this earlier, that the person is at the center of the treatment, including their family, loved ones, those individuals. Of course, being fully integrated, building, this was a really important piece from the members, is building on existing efforts. There's a lot of great work that's happening across the state that we really need to not recreate the wheel and really build on. A lot of conversation about reducing of administrative burden, and as we talked earlier, our system is very complex. Shared financial risk, and again, outcomes and measures that are sustainable. So with the first recommendation, which is the governance and finance model, this really focuses on developing this single point of accountability, which we're referring to as the governance model. That includes CCOs, CMHPs, local public mental health, schools, corrections, THS, anybody who really is involved and interested in building the well-being of their community. So these are just some bullets from the recommendation. So a focus on shared financial incentives. And again, as I mentioned, pulling together community organizations that are focused on the well-being of the community. We keep on talking about this accountability through metrics. And then really the effective use of the existing resources that we have and improved coordination. Some of our system is still on a fee-for-service model, and we really want to use or move to more of a value-based model approach and pay for outcomes. And then, again, making incentives similar to the CCOs through the governance model as they pool their resources and make decisions on those focus areas. standards of care and competency. This is really focused on if I were to go into a behavioral health center, and depending on where I go, which provider, I'm going to get a different experience. More importantly, I'm going to have different options of services, and there's not a basic package of services. When I go into one clinic, I'm not going to exactly get the same type of services, and we really want to try to create some consistency so where you go, you get the same type of services. We also want to make sure that our workforce and our systems are trauma-informed, that, again, we're focused on the person, the family, those individuals, culturally and linguistically appropriate services. A huge focus on prevention and really getting ahead of the curve and focusing on the social determinants of health. Lots of conversation about that. And we still probably didn't put enough in the collaborative just because that's so important. And then that our work is research-based and outcome-driven. Workforce. Without our workforce, we won't be able to accomplish anything. I keep on saying that we really need the people who are doing the work to have the skills and have the tools in order to do the work and enjoy their job. Because I come from 23 years of providing behavioral health services in the community. People love their jobs. They just don't have necessarily the right tools or, frankly, the right wages in order just to kind of to sustain the work. We also want to focus on developing standards, again, around the workforce, trauma-informed care, using team-based care models and approaches. A lot of discussion around making sure that we're sharing this information across the system and with each other as providers or CCOs, so coordination and collaboration around that. And then, again, to focus on the use of peer supports in order to meet the needs of our members. I personally have seen the use of peers in many different areas, and it's just that the impact is tremendous, where I, probably as a therapist, am not going to have the same impact. And then information exchange and coordination of care. Develop outcome-focused, person-centered measurement framework. So we have a lot of measurements that we track and we follow. We don't really have a measurement that says that, did I help you today as a provider? Did I provide something that you needed in order to make your life better? Was this a good experience for you? I don't think we have a tool that really measures that and measures client satisfaction. Holding collaborations around accountability for clinical and cost targets, using technology to integrate. We've developed, OHA has put forth the EDI and the pre-managed system, which has really helped with coordination across the system, and the requirement for CCOs to ensure that integration takes place. So we're in the process of developing our implementation plan. Through lots of conversations and discussions, we've decided that we don't need to make any legislative changes, that we have the authority through our contracting with CCOs and CMHPs to make the changes that we need. And what's interesting is that the CCOs who are in the room actually supported that, about making those changes. I was really excited about that. I'm hurrying up, sorry. We've developed work groups, a steering committee, an advisory committee, all those kinds of important infrastructure in order for us to make sure that we can move the work forward. And then Ben talked about the behavioral mapping tool. So.
And Royce, if I could just ask you to go back about three slides just to the value.
Oh, I missed that one.
That's okay.
Yeah,
so,
thank you about that.
And we'll just pause there. This is what we see as the value of peer mm-hmm. support and the work that we'll be incorporating in our regional governance efforts. So we'll stop there because
thank you.
3 minutes. Trying to be timing.
Thank you very much. We've got a bunch of people signed up to testify.
I have a question.
All right, make it quick.
I will make it quick.
All right.
And I was asked to ask this, so Ms. Sexton, I notice on your recommendations you had in your item 2D3, I won't go read it to you, but it has to do with contracted mandated language. And the question comes from the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association. What is OHA's commitment to fulfilling this peer support service contract language recommendation in its behavioral collaborative action plan?
So, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, our effort, we received that recommendation, and part of what we are excited about with this single point of shared accountability is the opportunity to not only include peer support services. I want to underscore that we are already required to do more of that work by the U.S. Department of Justice performance plan we're operating under. And also, we want to kind of think about a target ratio of peer support specialists to members. We have made more progress than many other states by setting goals as opposed to prescribing the exact mix of services a community must use. We're totally committed to incorporating peer support services in the mix, but we stop short of being prescriptive on all levels so that the local CCO and CMHP and the community itself can determine their needs and what needs to be provided. But we expect peer support services to be expanded through that ratio mechanism I mentioned, and I think we'll get the job done.
Thank you.
Thank you very
and
much.
And just a quick comment. Yeah. I know we're in a hurry. When I'm looking at the recommendations of peer support, will you be coming up with a strategic plan as well as timelines? Because it's pretty apparent what needs to be done. Okay, when are we going to have our standardized training model? When are we going to develop the standards for effective peer services? I mean, those, and I know all of that costs money, and so to me, reports are wonderful, but I really want to see an implementation date on so much of this.
Excellent. Chair Gelser, Senator Montes Anderson, our team, our health systems team and health policy team are already articulating that implementation plan and schedule. And again, this time it's going to have not just the plan, but the metrics, the money, the whole picture. And then we'll hold ourselves accountable to that plan. We're also happy to share it with all of you.
Thank you.
And for you to hold us accountable.
Thank you both very much. Okay, so we've got some folks. Craig, this is a different Craig Campbell. It just always happens that way. All right. So Eric Martin, Tony Vizina, and Johnny Gage. And I'm going to have to limit you each to 2 minutes just because we've got another 12 people on the next bill. And I've got a little timer because I don't like telling people to stop talking. It just seems so rude. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Eric Martin. I'm with the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon, and we certify about 4,000 addiction professionals and addiction peer support specialists in the state of Oregon. We were founded in 1977, and about half of our folks are in recovery from addiction themselves. In a lot of ways, we were the original peer program in Oregon, and half of our people are essentially peers. I don't know if you've seen this document. Is that? And I just want to mention that CADCs in Oregon perform significantly better than the national average. In a 6-year analysis by TEDS treatment episode data sets, CADCs in the SUD, the substance use disorder system in Oregon, have significantly better outcomes than the national average. I'm here today representing ACBO and our 4,000 members, and we're neutral on Senate Bill 51, but we would like it to be amended to include several seats for addiction treatment. So addiction treatment isn't specifically listed out in Senate Bill 51, and we would like to be included in the process. CADCs are the most culturally diverse behavioral health workforce in the state of Oregon. And for that reason alone, they should be included. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you reset the timer?
Yeah, I can't figure out how to do it.
It's okay. I needed more than 2 minutes anyways.
Yeah, you start talking and you're smarter than me.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd really like to say thank you for allowing me to come. I got to skip class today, and that's always a bonus for me. My name's Tony Vesna, and I'm the executive director of the Fourth Dimension Recovery Center. 4D is a nonprofit that provides addiction peer services to youth through a community center and also peer mentoring. Additionally, I'm a person who identifies in long-term recovery. I've been clean and sober since July 20th, 2012.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm here today to advocate for people in recovery in Oregon, both those who have found recovery, those who have yet to find recovery, and those who may never will or may never find recovery. People with addiction have been disenfranchised via the stigma attached to them and the felonies that are given out for drug possession. We have not been, in my opinion, represented in the social justice movements over the last 100 years. Equally disheartening, an example of that, addictions treatment seems to be the first to get cut when the state faces budget deficits. And right now, Oregon ranks 5th in teen drug dependence and 49th in providing accessible treatment to teens. Also, the Oregon Department of Correction reports that over 60% of all inmates have been diagnosed with substance abuse or substance dependence. So it seems to me that the only place we get representation is in the penitentiary. I'm here today to ask that the Behavioral Health Task Force hold at least one seat for addictions treatment. More so, I would like to see an addiction peer seat made available. I feel this would be good investment to start mending the mistakes of the past and providing a future for our young people facing addiction. I even know a young man who would be eager to apply to such a seat. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the members for allowing us to be here today. My name is Johnny Gage. I'm the director of the African American Behavioral Health and Addictions Treatment Coalition. The coalition is representative of about 50 providers, agencies, providers, practitioners, and consumers of behavioral health and addiction treatment. We strongly recommend, I mean, given the 2013 and 14 State of Equity Report, where there exist these glaring disparities in the African American community around addiction treatment. We just think that whenever addiction treatment is not specifically mentioned, it just falls by the wayside. It's almost gobbled up by behavioral health. So we strongly support the idea of having seats set aside on this task force for addiction treatment.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Just a comment to these. I know that the metrics that we have for addiction and treatment, I know we have, it's the treatment rate. But after talking with some of the judges see some of these people in the judicial system over and over again, I wish somehow we could have metrics that look at really what kind of treatment programs really do have no recidivism, and that means that yes, they can complete, but when they complete, do they then fall off again? And I'm hoping, and it's something that we brought up in the Justice Safety Conference, and so many people came up to me and said, yes, we do need to have a better system to really see which treatment programs really do have excellent outcomes.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Next up, we've got Craig Campbell and Laura Misras.
Craig doesn't
want to
come.
Craig does not want to come. Okay, great. And Laura?
I'd like to pass.
All right, thank you very much. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 51. Thank you all very much. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 860.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 860 requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to investigate parity of insurance reimbursements between behavioral mental health providers and those of medical providers and mental health providers with prescribing privileges. It requires DCBS to adopt rules ensuring implementation of mental health parity and network adequacy requirements based on their findings. It directs DCBS to report findings and adopted rules to the Legislative Assembly by September 1st, 2018, and it sunsets January 2nd, 2019. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you very much. J.L. Wilson, Pat Mooney, and Elizabeth Remley, please.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon Independent Mental Health Professionals, bringing Senate Bill 860 to you today. This comes to you from the mental health professional community, and although it's only 2 pages long, it is a powerful 2 pages. And it's come from many good people and many good organizations who have been part of the process to develop a bill that really gets to the heart of the question, and that is, do we really have mental health parity? parity, or do we just have mental health parity in name only? The elements of Senate Bill 860, we believe, are the elements that have to be addressed in order to answer the question in the affirmative that, yes, in fact, we do have real mental health parity in the state of Oregon. So before I turn it over to my friend here, Pat Mooney, I will say his presentation may take a few minutes because we're going to walk you through the specifics of the bill, but everybody behind us has been coached up to know to keep it tight. So we want to be conscious of your time, but that you also need to hear their voices. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for holding this hearing. My name is Patrick Mooney. I'm a psychologist here in Salem in clinical practice. Senate Bill 860, the goal of it is to assist the state in enforcing their obligation to enforce mental health parity in the way that was intended. We believe that Senate Bill 860 is a path to true mental health parity. So basically, mental health parity laws, both federal and state, require equivalent investment in both mental health and medical services. This starts with the development of provider panels, and resources should be placed in equal measure to both mental health and medical. This investment should assure that there's an adequate number of providers on each side, adequate number of specialists to cover the range of problems that are presented for service, and that you have an equal number of a range of education and experience levels for your providers. You don't want to have one side of the coin having like a robust panel and then on the other side people just out of graduate school. We want some equivalence there. The federal mental health parity law divides benefits into six areas of classification. This is in order to provide apples to apples kind of comparison. You don't want to compare in-network inpatient benefits to prescription drugs on one side or the other. You want equivalency. This bill in particular is looking at outpatient in-network services. Federal parity law goes further and divides the outpatient services into office visits. It allows that kind of subdivision. And this will be the crux of our bill to take a look at what is the equivalence in office visits across the medical and the mental health divide. There's some things that are working well in mental health parity, and that's the enforcement of what's called the quantitative treatment limitations. These are the limitations of the insurance plan's benefits, and it has to be equal across medical and mental health. So things like equal deductibles, equal copays, coinsurance, lifetime benefits, these are very measurable kinds of things, and it seems like this works quite well, that since it's so easily measured, that it seems to be enforced quite well in the state. What's not working well are processes, and those would be referred to as the non-quantitative treatment limitations. This involves things like how do the insurance plans go about establishing reimbursement rates for their providers? How do they assign those rates? What are their practices in reviewing for medical necessity, or what are the policies regarding pre-authorization of treatment? Those kinds of non-numerical kinds of processes aren't as easily measured. We believe, however, that outpatient mental health office visits are underpaid and overmanaged on the mental health side. The question exists is, why is this enforcement so weak? The federal parity law has been around since 1996. The Oregon mental health parity law has been around since 2005, partially because it's non-quantitative. It's more of a process that's looked at. Furthermore, there's about 8,000 of these procedure codes that are used to cover like all kinds of billing for different medical procedures and processes, but only about 10 or 15 of these codes are used for mental health services. You can't compare psychotherapy to like all medical benefits. It's just not an adequate way to go about, you know, looking for equivalence. You have to break it down. Furthermore, it's difficult to determine what practices that would govern like medical necessity for psychotherapy, how does that compare on the medical side? What's the equivalence in terms of making a judgment about medical necessity? And finally, often you have the mental health benefits are shipped to managed care companies who define like what rates are paid for providers in their on their panels, as well as decide the regulations for medical necessity and pre-authorization of treatment and those kind of management practices. It's sort of like sending manufacturing offshore to another country where the labor laws are different and the labor costs are low there. There is a cost, even though there may be some cost savings in aggressive management of reimbursement, there's a cost in terms of a lot of providers are leaving these panels that are poorly paid. So in earlier this year, we did a survey of 660 active outpatient therapists, and we asked them a number of questions, including whether they had ever left an in-network panel or had intended to leave. And we got about half of the people were saying that they had left a panel in the last 10 years. Another half said that they would probably leave a panel in another sometime in the future. 95% of them cite low reimbursement as a reason that they've left the panels. You also have the phenomenon of ghost panels where people are on the books, but they're not really taking patients. So you have Oregonians who are circling the runways looking for a place to land. They're trying to find a therapist who can deal with their problems. Unfortunately, they're calling around to, if they have a low-paid plan, they're often out of luck. And so they end up either paying for services out of pocket, which is expensive, or out of network, which is more than the in-network rates. So in some ways, it doesn't matter how well the quantitative treatment limitations are working. If you have consumers who aren't able to take advantage of equal copays because they're paying fully out of pocket for the services, or else, in the worst case scenario, they're giving up altogether. And this can actually be life-threatening when that happens. You might look at this as a subtle form of discrimination against people with mental health problems. If you have lopsided panels where you have a pretty robust panel of medical providers, but you have a pretty weak panel of mental health providers, or kind of a skimpy panel, in a sense, you're not, it's not equal treatment. You know, you'd be better off with diabetes or something like that rather than having a mental health problem. And finally, when the mind is not treated, the body suffers. So people with diabetes or heart disease who also have depression, most likely they're going to get worse. And they will need more expensive medical treatment. They may go to the emergency room. They may need hospitalization. So there is a cost, again, for not treating mental health problems. So the first step that we're asking the Department of Consumer and Business Services to take is to identify a service parallel to psychotherapy so you can compare apples to apples. So the typical primary care office visit requires a physician to do three things. They take a history of the problem, they do a physical exam of some sort, and then they make their medical decision about what to do for the problem. This is very similar on the psychotherapy side, where you take a history of the problem, you do some kind of psychodiagnostic evaluation, and then thirdly, you make some kind of decision about what the treatment is going to be. The equivalence goes further when you look at physicians can also spend their time consulting or counseling with their patient that comes in the office. In those cases, they don't have to do those other three elements. They don't have to take a full history or a physical exam. All they have to do is document time, how much time they're spending with the patient and what actually happened in the session. So because we're talking about counseling and because we're talking about the time spent in the office visit, we see this as a very good metric to compare medical and mental health services on the outpatient side of things. So once you have the similar metric, you can start doing some studies about, you know, is there equivalence? So pillar one of our law, or I'm sorry, of our bill, asked the insurance division to look at historical trends. The orange line there is, it's a hypothetical mental health rate for office visit procedures for psychotherapists. And you'll see that the line is relatively flat in terms of reimbursement over the years. This is our experience over the last decade. For some insurance plans over the last two decades, there's been very little bump in the rate of pay for our services. We don't believe that this is likely happening over on the primary care physician side of things. Although their rates may have also slowed down, we believe it would be unsustainable to have health care if the primary care physicians weren't getting some kind of cost of living over the years. So we just asked the insurance division to look at this and then remedy it when there's not equivalence. The second pillar of this bill asks for an investigation and remedy of time-based office visit rates. So for example, in psychotherapy, if you spend 60 minutes with a client, Medicare will pay you 33% more in reimbursement value than a 45-minute session. So there's a little bump for the more time spent in the Medicare system. However, MOTA pays both the 60-minute and the 45-minute mental health procedural codes exactly the same rate. There's no difference in pay for spending extra time. And our question is there equivalency here? Does MOTA pay longer physician office visits the same rate as it's true in the mental health world? Regents, in a similar way, pays the 60-minute session only 7% more than the 45-minute session. And does Regents also restrict the incremental increase in reimbursement for on the physician side for their office visits? So here's a graph that shows what I'm talking about. The red bars represent primary care physician office visits. At the bottom, you can see that there's different lengths of time that the physician might spend in the office visit. The last two bars, you can see it's a 15-minute increase in time, going from a 25-minute to a 40-minute visit. And the higher bar on the far right represents an incremental increase in reimbursement for that extra time. Our experience is in the blue bars, going from a 45-minute code to a 60-minute code, there's very little bump in terms of reimbursement for most of the insurance plans. It's either equal or just maybe slightly raised. So this would not be a parity situation. Pillar three asks the insurance division to investigate the policies and procedures that govern their decision-making regarding these time-based office visits. Do insurance plans impose policy restrictions, or do they actively manage the physician's visits if they go a little bit longer than usual? An example of this on the mental health side is how Providence works. Providence has their mental health benefits managed by Optum, a subcontractor. And Optum and Providence restrict the 60-minute session to like specific therapies. So they say that you can only work with a patient for 60 minutes if you do things like exposure therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder or OCD or panic disorder, but not for depression, not for some kind of anxiety disorder, not for some family mental health issue. Our question, is there a parallel Providence policy that is also restrictive of the longer physician office visits? Does it say that only if somebody comes in with diabetes that's dysregulated can you spend longer time with that patient? And lastly, we asked the insurance division to take a look at the provider rate schedules in network across mental health and medical. And are they determined in an equivalent way? So when the insurance plans are building their provider panels, how do they go about assigning how much to pay to for any one procedure code? Physicians, we would guess, might use some kind of standardized Medicare relative value unit, a work-based unit in determining what the rates are. For many of the mental health people, the insurance plans use more of a managed care rate or some kind of rate that may be more arbitrary or allow the management to be able to pay for itself, but takes away from the what's reimbursed on the provider side. So basically, does this result in provider panels that are not equivalent across medical and mental health? Finally, I leave you with this. Weak parity enforcement, it's like permitting a contractor to build a house with high-paid carpenters and low-paid electricians. We believe that's not a healthy system, and we urge you to build a strong house here and support Senate Bill 860.
Great, thank you very much. Are there questions? No? Great. Thank you both very much. All right, our next panel is Ann Emmett. Beth. Yes, Beth.
Just really quick.
Yes, of course.
Okay. I'm sorry I wasn't here.
That's okay.
I was at the end of the list, so I thought I'd
call. Sorry. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations of Counselors and Therapists. They represent the licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists in the state of Oregon, of which there are several thousand licensees and interns, providing mental health across all various clinical services. And
Elizabeth, did you introduce yourself for the record?
Elizabeth Remley. We're here with the previous presenters to have a conversation, not necessarily about rates, but about what it means when mental health providers are disincentivized in a system to provide mental health. So when we have a system that's not equivalent to physical health in how we reimburse our mental health providers and what we pay them to do, then we end up, what it ends up looking like on the patient end is inequitable access to care for mental health. We have an access problem because we have a provider problem where we aren't encouraging people to be in the profession. We're not encouraging them to be under contract with insurance companies. We're not encouraging them to provide adequate care because we're not reimbursing them appropriately. We want to find out what it looks like to have truly equitable mental health care in the commercial insurance space. And that's what we're hoping this bill will do to start that conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right, next up we have Ann Emmett, John Milnes, and Melissa Todd. Welcome.
Thank you.
Please, go
start?
Ahead.
Okay.
Yep, and just start with your name for the record and then
yes.
Tell us your story.
All righty. Thank you very much for having us. My name is Ann Emmett. I'm a licensed clinical social worker with about 30 years practice. Currently, I'm in full-time private practice. Prior to that, I've worked the bulk of my career in community mental health, both outpatient and inpatient, a little bit of administrative work, but for about the past 15 years had a part-time private practice. I'm a solo practitioner, sole income, and it's been difficult to try to kick that into full gear here with a full practice, and at this point I'm asking that you support Senate Bill 860 for the following reasons. One, the disparity in the reimbursement rates for the several panels that I'm on range, just to give you an idea, range from my full fee, which at this point is $120 per session, to less than half my full fee. Mm-hmm. So trying to sustain a business with such a fluctuation in reimbursement rates has been very difficult. The other main concern that I have is with my patients. All of the factors that Patrick Mooney had mentioned really limit access and choice for a patient. When they are not able to find anybody on their panel, when their insurance company no longer has out-of-network benefits, they're sort of stuck, you know, so they don't really have a choice. I wanted to give you just two examples that I've been recently struggling with. One individual. I work with adults. One individual I've been working with for about 2 years. We have a treatment relationship. There's been a lot of past trauma that she's been working on. She also, for the past 7 years, has had a foster child who's now a teenager, who at has her own history of trauma, and so a lot of the work that individually we've been doing is trying to deal with what. You know, how can she manage her own trauma and not get too reactive with the teenager? This woman's insurance recently changed to Optum, which is under the Providence umbrella. This is one of the panels I'm not on that I really do not want to be on, frankly, because of some of the reputation that I've heard. But this woman's on a limited income, and really, I actually offered to see her pro bono at either no fee or a very low fee. That was not comfortable for her, but she really needs treatment. Things are difficult at home. So I applied to be on this panel. I'm considering that, and this is not a sustainable model for me, you know, because they're at the lower end of the reimbursement rate. The another patient that I've been working with also for about 2 years is on PBH, which is also connected with Providence. When she found out I was, considering getting on this panel with Providence, she was very concerned because she could no longer afford the copays. She was afraid that she would have to pay considerably higher copays and couldn't afford to continue therapy. So we basically agreed if I can, you know, we'll figure something out. So anyway, I want to just encourage you to support this. Support this bill. I'm concerned that newer clinicians are having a hard time just seeing private practice as a viable economic way to make a living, and we need independent mental health practitioners out there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Melissa Todd. I am a psychologist in Eugene, and I have been in private practice since the end of 2014, so I'm probably one of those newer people. On February 6th of this year, I made a very difficult decision to terminate my contract with UBH Optum, and you've been hearing a lot about them today, and that's with very good reason. I want to share with you my personal story for why I made this very, very difficult decision that I've actually been agonizing over for the past 2 years, because I really do feel like I'm letting people down by making this decision. While I've been working with UBH Optum, I have felt constantly pressured to limit the care that I'm giving to the people that I'm working with, regardless of what their medical necessity or need is. I'm told to limit my appointments with them to 45 minutes. I don't do that. I meet with them for 60 minutes, and I just don't get paid for the extra 15 minutes because it's not ethically right for me to limit their care, because that's what the insurance company is telling me to do. If I meet with somebody for too long of a period of time, I'm discouraged from continuing to meet with them. If I meet with people who have high acuity, I am discouraged from providing them with the extra care that they might need to get through a crisis. Off the bat, you know, I feel like I am being asked to discriminate against people who have more severe mental illnesses, because those are exactly the people who are going to trigger these aggressive clinical reviews. If I am working with somebody, for instance, who has bipolar 1 disorder, it's a chronic, lifelong condition that can sometimes be debilitating and sometimes be life-threatening. Off the bat, I know that I'm going to be getting paid 50% less to be working with this person, and very likely I'm going to be coordinating with psychiatrists. I'm going to be doing possibly research outside of sessions. I might be taking after-hours phone calls, none of which I get paid for. And if I happen to see this person in crisis, UBH Optum actually reimburses 25% less for a crisis session than they do for a regular psychotherapy session. I don't understand why, and there's a clear message there. If I appropriately bill that appointment, I'm going to be reimbursed less money for doing harder work and saving the company money by preventing that person from going to a higher level of care, such as hospitalization. If I inaccurately bill the appointment to get that 25% extra reimbursement, then I'm doing something that's unethical and creating a situation where UBH Optum has inaccurate records about the acuity of that person. Recently, I was called to a clinical review by UBH Optum because I saw a person in crisis and saw them twice a week for the next 2 weeks just to give them some extra care. That triggered a clinical review. I didn't think there was going to be a problem because these clinical reviews are typically for medical necessity, and there was no question in my mind that my treatment for this person was medically necessary. When I did the review, I was told that my treatment may not be effective, because if my treatment was effective, this person wouldn't be struggling so much. So I got sent to an even higher level of review, where I was then told that I would be given leeway for the time being, but I was encouraged to titrate down their treatment as soon as possible. So, you know, this is just one example of what I've been going through for the past 2 years, and it creates an ethical bind for me because I don't want to be working for the insurance companies, and I don't want my primary objective to be to limit care. And so I thank you very much for listening to my story.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and other members of the committee, my name is John Milnes. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and have been in private practice here in Salem for over 30 years at the same location. I'm here representing the Oregon Independent Mental Health Professionals in support of Senate Bill 860. I last provided testimony in 2015 in support of reasonable reimbursement rates for all mental health providers. Unfortunately, the reimbursement problem continues and have been stagnant for many years. The problem was greatly exacerbated in 2009 when Blue Cross drastically slashed their reimbursement rates. If I was a younger man, I would not be sitting here in front of you because I would be working for the state or another agency. I couldn't afford to take the risk of starting a private practice. Clinicians in private practice have fixed expenses that do not flex with sudden drops in reimbursement, such as we experienced in 2009. Overhead expenses continue to go up, and my office staff deserves annual raises. I'm only able to sustain my private practice in recent years as I work very long hours. Throughout the year, many Oregonians will spend a considerable amount of time trying to find a therapist or counselor to address their family needs. Some give up and rely solely on medication, and this increases the number of visits to primary care physicians, and they don't need any more visits. Primary and mental health care professionals must be supported with reasonable reimbursement rates based on parity. Failure to treat both physical and mental health conditions in a comprehensive manner results in poorer health outcomes and higher health costs. It is estimated that anywhere from 11 to 36% of primary care patients have a psychiatric disorder, yet the average primary care appointment is only 13 minutes. Clearly not enough time. Over the years, I have thought it's very important to remain on as many panels, insurance panels, as possible to provide affordable access to individuals and families needing mental health services. However, because reimbursement rates have been very challenging for a long time, I finally decided that it was necessary to go out of network with two of the largest insurers in the state. I am now able to compare in-network copayments versus out-of-network copayments with the same insurer. Sadly, the client copayments, after meeting their out-of-network deductible, is 7 to 8 times higher with me being out-of-network. This type of expense is unsustainable for many clients, but also the reimbursement rates were unsustainable for me. We know from outcome surveys that talk therapy provides the necessary focus and time to help people overcome such problems as depression and anxiety. Psychologists, clinical social workers, and licensed professional counselors all do well in achieving positive outcomes through talk therapy. I think Senate Bill goes a long way to improve access for individuals, families needing mental health services. Also, we talk about cost. If we increase access, it is actually a cost savings measure, as clients frequently utilize fewer medical services the year following their mental health treatment. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Next up, we have Don Moore, Mike Marshall, and David Sant. And we have about 10 minutes before we have to leave the rooms. Are we missing one person? Don?
Moore.
Moore. Okay, yeah. Great.
Chairman Gelser, my name is Don Moore. I appreciate the opportunity and fellow members of the committee to hear the testimony. As a father, I'm a father of a daughter with schizophrenia, longtime member and past president of NAMI of Multnomah, and current vice president of North Star Clubhouse Advisory Board. I strongly urge the passage of Senate Bill 860. Throughout my years of advocacy, I've testified on behalf of mental health parity and watched some progress being made, but it pains me to talk with mental health care providers and hear stories of practices of insurance companies that blatantly undermine the intent of the original Oregon parity law and subsequent legislation passed at the federal level. These practices, which Senate Bill 860 is designed to reverse, are what many patients need in order to assure access to resources to help them move forward in their recovery. The resources that this bill would remedy will result in providers being able to meet the needs of our fellow citizens. 2 years ago, the son of a very dear friend of mine took actions of ingesting materials that resulted in his untimely death, wrongfully thinking that he would be cured by his actions. While he was afforded full medical care involving surgeries and blood transfusions, there were not mental health resources available that might have prevented him from taking those illogical actions. These and other situations are not strictly a medical problem, as there are many therapies that have been proven effective in promoting recovery. That insurers have unreasonably restricted and unfairly reimbursed effective treatments is shameful and harmful to the citizens who are in need. The harm that can be created by a lack of services is oftentimes well in excess of the resultant harm that can result in the failure to access proper treatments. And those should be available in the same manner as necessary medical care. Please act for fairness and equality of those in need of psychiatric care and move Senate Bill 860 forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is David Sant, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker and board member of the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon Chapter. A professional association founded in 1971 that represents over 1,500 Oregon social workers. Social workers are trained in mental and behavioral health and provide over half of the talk therapy in this state, including individual, family, and relationship counseling. Many of our members are social workers in private practice who contract with insurance companies to provide talk therapy similar to other mental health care providers. On behalf of NASW Oregon, I'm here to ask for your support of SB 860. Oregon Mental Health Parity Law acknowledges that mental health is just as vital to one's overall wellness as physical health and ensures that Oregonians have access to mental health services as part of their insurance plans. Unfortunately, private insurance companies have demonstrated that they are not in compliance with existing law and have been limiting reimbursement to providers in several ways. Our members report that maximum allowable rates for LCSWs may have actually decreased 50% under some plans. As a result of these practices, providers have been forced to either accept inadequate reimbursement or not enter into contracts with insurers at all. When fewer providers are willing to go in-network, the result is a narrowing of provider panels within insurance plans, and some providers have even gone out of business. The impact to consumers is fewer choices and restricted access to mental health care, which is contrary to the spirit of Oregon mental health parity law. Oregonians should have options for mental health care just like they do for medical care. When people have fewer options to seek mental health treatment, symptoms can escalate and result in crises that are expensive for payers, consumers, and the state. NASW stands in solidarity with mental health practitioners and the Oregonians that they serve and ask you to vote yes on SB 860.
Thank you both so much. Is Mike Marshall still here and wants to speak? No? All right. Well, thank you all very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on
this minute.
Oh, yes.
This bill, our DCBS hasn't been here to talk to it, as well as none of the carriers, and this bill would affect both of them. So I would hope that if we're going to pursue this bill, that they will please
come forward.
Thank you.
Yes.
I would like to testify if there's a moment for
the... Sure, we have like 2 minutes until we've got to leave. What's your name?
I'll be really clear. My name is Tracy Bryce Farmer. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. When I was a brand new therapist fresh out of social work school, I started working at Providence Hospital with a patient that I will call Stevie. Stevie has the kind of trauma history that gives even the crustiest clinician nightmares. She has Providence Medicare, and her mental health care is administered by Optum. I began to quickly realize that the relationship with me was the first stable relationship Stevie had ever had. She began to make progress in a therapeutic alliance. She showed up every week, and she worked really hard. She decided to live. Eventually, I left Providence to start my private practice. I knew that it was appropriate for me to keep seeing Stevie and patients like her, so I applied to get on the panel, and I felt proud of myself for working for them. Imagine my dismay when I discovered in private practice the open secret that all therapists knew, namely that some panels were much worse to be on than others, that some fee schedules paid a social worker less than half of their rate, and that some insurance companies would dog my office with misinformation, administrative deterrence, aggressive auditing, and ultimately denials for routine medical services. I was very moved by the testimony earlier about the suicidal attempts and ideation that people suffer from. Stevie's recovery needs, secondary to her trauma history, include management of anxiety, depression, relational distress, social isolation, relapse prevention for addiction, suicidal ideation with a history of multiple suicide attempts, and psychosis. I wish that this staggering list of symptoms was more unusual for Oregonians. I'm really pleased to hear about all the legislation today because, unfortunately, this is all too common. What I discovered is that Optum cracks down on longer time codes of 90837, the 60-minute code, as a matter of course. I don't need to speak about that. Everybody here has spoken about that beautifully. I want to keep seeing Stevie. I want to see the patients like her. I don't want to risk their hard-earned recovery by shunting them off to another clinic where they might not get seen but once every 6 weeks and eventually fall through the cracks and out of treatment. I haven't left the panel yet, but I have to keep asking myself, can my practice survive at the rate of pay that Optum pays me for a 45-minute session? Can my business keep eating the time that is required to deal with their draconian deterrence practices? If I stay on this panel to treat Stevie and my other Optum patients, can I afford my overhead? Many therapists decide that they simply cannot. There's patients like Stevie, and there's also middle-class citizens who experience obstacles that prevent them from getting mental health care. Every day I have people ask me on the phone, why in the world can't I find a good therapist who takes my insurance? I thought I had good insurance. Why does everybody who's listed on my panel say that they're full? Why is my therapist leaving my insurance? Do I really have to start over with somebody who's brand new? Why do I have to cut my sessions down to 45 minutes when the hour isn't long enough? All of these patients wrestle with the same logical question. Wait, I thought I had mental health care as part of my insurance coverage. SB 860 will keep Oregon at the forefront of its fight for comprehensive medical care as a civil right. The distinction between mental and physical health care is false. The brain is a physical organ that requires care like every other human organ. I urge you to please vote yes on this crucial legislation, and thank you for letting me say my piece for Stevie and the people that we see every single day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 860. And we have exhausted our... Do we want to suspend the rules to allow Senator Olson to vote?
Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Olson to vote on Senate Bills 239 and 830.
Senator Dimbrough has moved to suspend the rules so that Senator Olson can vote. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Senator Olson.
I vote aye on 239 and aye on 830. Thank you.
Please record that. And with that, we are closed. With that, we are closed.